Good morning.
Good morning.
Continuing in our series looking at the cross, today we're going to be thinking a bit differently. I find it quite challenging to do this sort of thing, but I'm going to be walking us through history, a bit of historical theology of the way the cross or the way the cross saves us has been viewed, some different models. The cross of Christ stands at the centre of human history. We divide time by it, don't we, before and after. It's the most significant moment and the culmination of each of the Gospels of Jesus. But why did Jesus die and how does his death save us is an important thing for us to grasp and to understand. In the famous hymn, And Can It Be, and we'll sing it later, we often sing this: 'Tis mystery all, the immortal dies, who can explore this strange design? The death of Jesus is a mystery in the sense that we marvel at this costly and wonderful demonstration of love and self-sacrifice. Why would God do that for us? We marvel at how wonderful it is that God would choose this most surprising way of salvation, and that his Son, Jesus Christ, the second person of the Trinity, would enter the world as a humble human being, die upon the cross at Calvary, and rise again to glory. We read similarly in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, then 22 and 23, that the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Today, I want to show you the different facets of the way the cross works. As a diamond held in your hand that you turn and see different refractions of light, the beauty of its different faces, I want to show you what the cross does in terms of how it affects us and God and impacts our salvation. By walking through different models of how the cross saves us and the way that has been perceived and taught over time, culminating in what I believe is the central idea, which is that of penal substitutionary atonement, which I will explain a bit today and will be a key part of how we're thinking about the cross as we go through this series. In the early church period, the emphasis was often placed on how the cross was God's victory over Satan, and therefore he was able to rescue humanity from the grasp of Satan, sin and death. So on the next slide, we'll see them. Sorry, I jumped you too far ahead now, Joanne, on the previous from this one. The model here is called Christus Victor, the model of the atonement, and it's often combined with the idea of ransom. And so in the early days of Christianity, through his death and resurrection, Jesus invaded enemy territory, conquering Satan, and set the captives free. You can see this picture of the harrowing of hell, where Jesus is prying open Satan's mouth to allow the prisoners of hell free and to save them. And he does that by conquering Satan. The second century bishop of Lyon, Irenaeus, he wrote a five-book treatise called Against Heresies, and he refuted the Gnostic teaching of his day. He emphasized that Christ was the new Adam, who recapitulated, relived all the mistakes that Adam made but did it right, and in doing so was able to redeem humanity. And part of that was his death on the cross. You might recall in Romans chapter 5, Jesus is described as the new Adam, and he overcomes the way Adam led the human race into sin and destruction. Origen of Alexandria was another influential leader and prolific writer, this time in the 3rd century. I think we're going a bit too far ahead, Joanne, if you go back to the two characters here. Yes. So Origen was a guy in the 3rd century who developed this idea of Jesus conquering Satan further, and the idea that Jesus was put forward as a ransom, a la Mark 10:45. Jesus says the Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many, didn't he? What Origen then went too far with, in my view, is saying that that ransom was paid to Satan because Satan had dominion and rights over us and he needed to be bought out. And Origen even went as far as to say, and this idea developed, that Jesus was like a baited hook, and the bait was his humanity, and he tricked Satan into trying to punish Jesus, the human, but then was revealed the hook, that Jesus is truly divine. And so Satan had overreached his rights by trying to punish the divine, and therefore he'd gone too far and then relinquished his power over humanity, and therefore Jesus was able to rescue humanity from Satan's grasp. But I believe all of that is to give Satan too much power. That's not how the Bible describes him, is it? Rather, he only has the delegated authority that God gives him. Yes, he is the ruler of the prince of the air, the ruler of this earth, but only in a delegated way by God. And he only has as much rope as God gives him. Yes, Jesus was given as a ransom. Yes, he won victory over Satan, and therefore we have nothing to fear from Satan. But the ransom wasn't paid to Satan. The debt we owe is a debt that we have sinned against God. And so it's God who needs to be satisfied. If we're stereotyping, this Christus Victor model of the atonement is probably associated with Eastern Orthodox Christianity. Now, that's not a very nuanced statement, but just to give you something to hang on. As we progress further, we think in the 11th century, this guy Anselm of Canterbury was a major proponent of the satisfaction theory. And in feudal thinking, there was a lord of the manor who, if he was wronged, needed to be... He was wronged, that was a big shame, and so you needed to bring back honour to the lord. And so the model was that in sinning against God, humanity has committed dishonour to God, the Lord, and that there needed to be satisfaction provided. And so Jesus, in his death on the cross, won a great amount of merit, and that merit should be doled out to people to save them and to provide satisfaction to God. Now, this has the right strategy of recognizing that the cross is a Godward appeasement, not a Satan overcoming, but I still think there's some issues here which we'll talk about. It's right to recognize that we cannot satisfy God by our own merits, and therefore God became man in Jesus Christ to offer an infinite gift of obedience and death, satisfying God's offended honour. Anselm spells this out in his treatise, Why God Became Man. And one of the great steps forward that Anselm made in his theological thinking was to emphasise the dual natures of Christ, that he must be human because humanity has incurred the debt and justice requires that a human pay it. But he also must be God, divine, because the debt is infinite. Only a being of infinite worth has the capacity to pay it. And so Jesus is fully man and fully God. As we read in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 16 and 17, surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. So, if we're stereotyping again, this satisfaction model of the atonement might be associated with Roman Catholicism. doling out the merits of the storehouse of God's grace through the work of Christ. The third model of atonement that we're going to look at this morning is the moral influence, or Christ the exemplar. This view focuses on the heart of man rather than the justice of God. Sin blinds humanity to God's immense love, making us fearful and rebellious and being the root cause of our sin. On the cross, God demonstrates the absolute zenith of his sacrificial love. And seeing Christ suffer for us melts our hard hearts, awakens deep repentance, and inspires us to live lives of self-giving love. Jesus Christ's sacrifice is seen as a heroic example of what is possible for humanity in self-denial and love. He's opened the way not so much by winning salvation for us, but by showing us what's possible, being like the breach head to show humanity how to live truly in self-sacrificial love. This guy Peter Abelard in the 12th century, he countered the medieval legal views by emphasising that the cross is primarily a divine display of love meant to elicit our devotion. Now, we can certainly find lots of support for Christ's death on the cross as an example and model for us to follow, like 1 John 3:16. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. This view has later also been taken up strongly by Enlightenment thinkers, and in that kind of modern progress mantra of the 19th century especially, where humanity was progressing better and better and we would continue to improve and everything was optimism, we viewed the human race as primarily good. And so Christ's example would motivate us to live holy lives and to please God by our good works outweighing our bad. However, the major world wars, the Holocaust, the failings of modernism and globalisation have put a major dent in the optimism modern ideas that came with the Enlightenment and rationalism, and so have challenged this. This model of the atonement, moral influence, it fails to properly account for human sin and guilt, and the Bible's insistence that everyone is sinful and deserving of God's wrath. As we see in Romans 3 and other places, we cannot save ourselves. So no matter how great an example or teacher Jesus is, we need more than just example or instruction. We cannot save ourselves. It's certainly true that Christ is an example to us, and that once we're saved, we ought to follow his example, taking up our cross to follow him, loving as he has loved us, being holy as he is holy. But Christ is our influence and example only as we strive to live out the Christian life, not as a basis for our salvation by our own strength and moral uprightness. If we're stereotyping again, this moral influence theory of the atonement is probably ascribed to kind of liberal thinking or progressive Christianity, which finally brings us to the core of the cross. So I hope you can see that these are elements of the reality of what Christ has achieved. I'm not dismissing all of these ideas out of hand, but wanting to critique them and help you see the strengths and weaknesses, but ultimately culminate in what I believe is the central reality of the way the cross works, this idea of penal substitutionary atonement. And the idea of Christ as a sacrifice for sins is clearly not new, though it gained very much prominence in the Reformation and through the line of the church that we belong following that in the Reformed Protestant Church. However, you can see it clearly from the scriptures and from earliest stages. It was really nailed down during the Reformation by people like John Calvin. However, I want to show you that the New Testament, and especially the book of Hebrews, presents Christ's death upon the cross as a sacrifice, but not one that has to be offered repeatedly like those of the Old Testament. Christ offered himself as the perfect and complete once for all sacrifice of atonement. Isaiah 53 spells it out magnificently centuries before the life of Christ. And in Romans, Paul is in great pains to show how Christ's sacrifice is the necessary substitute in our place to take our penalty and to satisfy God's wrath. Athanasius in the 4th century pointed to Christ's divinity and Trinitarian unity with God the Father as enabling him to offer himself to the Father in our place and redeem us through his offering and sacrifice. As we read in 1 Corinthians 5:7, Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Augustine took up the torch for this understanding in the early 5th century and clarified that in this sacrifice, Christ was both the victim and the priest. He offered himself up as a sacrifice. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century synthesized satisfaction with penalty elements, affirming Christ suffered as a substitute for humanity's penalty for their sin. And in the 16th century, the idea of the threefold office of Christ developed: Jesus as prophet, priest, and king. He is a prophet since he declares the will of God, priest since he makes sacrifice for sin, and king since he rules with authority and will return to judge. And this threefold office of Christ is taken up strongly in the Protestant Reformation, like people like Calvin and Martin Luther. Finally, J.I. Packer and John Stott in the 20th century defended this doctrine against liberal theologians and wanted to affirm that penal substitutionary atonement is at the heart of the Christian faith and a right understanding of the cross of Christ. It's important to recognise that holding this idea of the cross that we understand from scriptures as central is not dismissing the way Christ has won a victory over Satan, is a model for us to follow, provides satisfaction to God, but helps us understand the primary purpose of the cross and how salvation is achieved for us. We're going to continue to come back to this idea in the weeks ahead, but now I just want to break it down a little bit so that we can understand it properly. Firstly, the cross is penal. Christ took upon himself the penalty prescribed by God's holy law for our sin. We're all sinners, and the penalty for sin is death. God is judge, and in his courtroom, justice must be upheld. The penalty must be paid for God to be satisfied. Secondly, the cross is substitutionary. Whilst it's a judgment that we deserve, we cannot tolerate that would be our destruction, our eternal judgment, our eternal damnation. And so Jesus has stepped in as our substitute to bear our sin himself. The model for this idea of substitution is the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, isn't it? Where an animal stood in the place to take the consequence in place of the person who has wronged God. Now, in the Old Testament, it's a third-party animal who has nothing to do with the matter. But we understand that Jesus, as the second person of the Trinity, puts himself forward to bear the judgment against our sin as a willing substitute in our place. Thirdly, the cross achieves atonement. By bearing our guilt, he removes our condemnation and reconciles us, makes us at one with God, reconciles us to God. Where now our sin is atoned for and God's justice is appeased. There we go. We've raced through quite a bit of history and a bit of understanding of the way the cross works. But in conclusion, I hope that we can marvel at the love of God and the wondrous work of Christ. And so we're going to sing in a moment this beautiful hymn. And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Saviour's blood? Died he for me who caused his pain? For me who him to death pursued? Amazing love. How can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? Let's stand and sing, marvelling at our wonderful God and his love for us demonstrated at the cross.